This brought back memories to me. I remember as I was getting ready to be a scout. We were going to scout camp. Up in the barn, there was a canvas that had been up there, a big canvas, for years. And I said to Dad, "Can I have that canvas?" And he said, "What do you want to do with it?" I said, "Well, I want to make a tent out of it. I could take that canvas, and I haven't seen anybody use it. I don't even know where it come from. But anyway, yeah, you can have it." So I got that canvas down, and I fixed it so that I sewed one end in it and figured out how to put two ends in it and left a kind of a hole up to the top so I could put a pole through it and string it up on a pole and stake it down, fix so I could sewed some ties on it so I could stake it down. That was my scout tent. I went ahead and got some wax and, went through a whole rigmarole to waterproof that tent. Gosh, I just got it ready to go. And I'm not real sure which one of the older boys wanted it, but they was going to go get the water. Now, they'd got the water down here out of this ditch all these years. But that day, they had to have the tent. I just coaxed and bawled and pleaded and everything else that I didn't want them to take my tent. They took it. And went down there, and they'd never put a canvas dam in. They'd heard about it. And they used boards with had a nail or two in it. And they got the canvas dam in, and it didn't hold, washed around the side, and so they jerked it out and caught that canvas on a nail and tore that tent in two. Now, they didn't have a canvas dam, and I didn't have a tent either. I like to never forgive those guys for that. I have forgiven them. I still remember it. I like the old boy. I forgive and forget, but still remember. But anyway, when they filled that combine out in the middle of that ball field, I remembered that story. And then I remembered one time when I was 12, 13, long in those age, they started a ball team uptown, a junior league. And I went up to catch, and I could have got on that team as catcher. You know, I wanted to play ball, but no way, no way. None of those guys, they said, "We've never had time to play ball, and you're not going to play ball." Well, what they had to do and what I had to do, I didn't think had anything to do with it. But when they put that combine out there, I remembered these two stories. Now, my kids have had time to play ball. I know they didn't have any junior league around here till we got to Neil. Neil and Craig and Mark played Little League Baseball. And I got to enter one in here right now. We used to go up and watch it. And I remember one day Vaughn Blair was the coach of the team that Craig was on. And well, Craig, he was going up to the plate, he was whirling that bat around just like old Babe Ruth himself. And I believe Mark was standing there and said, "You know, Craig's going to get a hit. That pitcher don't think he can hit it." That pitcher threw that ball right straight across that plate, and Craig got a hold of it with that bat, and he put it way out over second base's head, way out there in the field, and around the bases went Craig, just as hard as he could run. Now, he run just hard as anybody, but not quite as fast as some. And around, and as he got to first base, the first base coach was trying to stop him. But he just rounded that plate and headed for second. This guy up out there in the field picked that ball up and throwed it to second and overthrew the second baseman. And Craig touched that base, and old Vaughn Blair was over coaching third, and he was just a waving his arms and a shout, and "Stop, Craig, stop, Craig." And And old Craig touched that second base and right around and he headed for third. And the kid gathered up the ball and threw it to third base and throwed it over the third baseman's head and into the bleachers. And old Vaughn was a hollering, "Stop here, Craig, stop here." And old Craig rounded and, "Golly, golly, I couldn't hardly hear for Julia sitting there at the side of me in the car and just a screaming to the top of her voice, run, Craig, run, run, just, and good land." And he touched third base and rounded it and headed for home. And they gathered up the ball out of the bleachers and throwed it to the catcher and throwed it over his head. And Craig had a home run. And Vaughn and I have laughed about that many times. And I believe that done old Craig more good, and I know it did his mother, and that was quite a thing. But so I'll enter this ball story right here. Now I'm going to tell a little bit about Howard. Howard was a good guy. I think Howard was the first one of the family to graduate from high school. Now if I'm wrong, why I stand corrected, but that's my impression. Ariel didn't, Owen didn't, neither did Horace. They thought they had too much here home to do, but I know Dad talked to me and about going to school and graduating, and he said, "I'd like to see you get as much school as you can." And he said, "My golly, I was clear down here quite a ways before I got one of these kids graduating from high school. It would have been better off they'd all graduated from high school." Anyway, Howard was pretty good to me. I could communicate. I could talk to Howard. And seemed always could. I've told about him going on a mission in another place, and I'm not going to bring that in here. I know when I was going to high school after Mother died, that I signed Howard's name to my report card. Teacher would give me the report card, and I'd take a pen, sign Howard's name to it, and give it back to him. I couldn't see any sense letting him see that report card. But anyway, we owned that 36 Chevy together. Gosh, he was 11 years older than I was, but he went with me. He didn't date much, and I don't know why he didn't, really. He never got started till, good land, he never got married till he knew better. Till he's old enough, he should have known better. But I think he was 30 years old when he went on mission. So he's 32 or better when he come back. But anyway, I got along pretty good, I think, with Howard all the years. I had pretty good communication with him. We got mixed up. Got some partnership on some equipment there in the latter years. And finally, I said, "Well, good land, if we're going to have trouble with that, why, let's just trade this thing around. You can have what you want, because I'm not going to have any trouble with you." Now May was the next one, and I guess May really raised me. As a kid, I'm not sure who my mother was, or whether it was actually Mother or May. And I guess May told me once that I was her baby. Now, I guess I'd taken the place of Ruth in the family, and Mother's health wasn't too good in my lifetime. And by golly, Mother and I went down and watched May graduate from college. Got a 2-year degree. Reed said she came home that afternoon and helped us all thin beets, and I didn't remember that. But I don't know that I ever had any trouble with my sister. I always thought an awful lot of her. And I've seen her a time or two a year ever since. I've tried to check on her to help her. And But I guess she got married, I think, in 1932, when I was 12 years old. Well, we'd see her a time or two a year after that, but haven't really known that much about her. And, I know when Horace, one night, sitting here talking to Dad, said, "What do you think of your son-in-law, prospective son-in-law?" Dad said, "Oh, I don't know. He seems all right. Why?" "Well, he's a fine guy," and he went on to tell about it. "Well," Dad said, "well, he looks a little better than some of the stock running around town here, so it looks all right to me." He kind of got along with May's judgment, I guess, for her husband. Yeah, May always tells a story on me. We had some lambs tied down the fence line between us and the railroad. The railroad ran right along just north of our house here all the years until, well, I guess I was married and Ray was a baby, little boy. Sit out here and watch them tear up that line that year. And they used to send a weed burner along to burn the weeds down the track. And we looked out and here come that burner up there, and we run down there to untie those lambs and get them away from the fence. And she always quoted me as saying, "By golly, we sure hurried. We got down there and got that done in 15 minutes. And if my calculation of time wasn't too good, I guess. And maybe it was about like my speed, I don't know, but she kids me about that. Reed and I suppose, was closer than any. Reed and I always scuffled and wrestled together, played. I know Howard, the year Reed came home from his mission, I may have told this story, but I'm going to tell it again just in case. Reed and I was supposed to go, one of us was supposed to take a change of teams and go over and take relieve Howard on the binder. And Reed said, "I'll wrestle you for it 2 out of 3 times. Well, I thought, well, that's kind of ridiculous, because he knows darn well I can throw him down. And Ariel was there, and he said, "Well, I'll sit here in the shed and referee it." Well, we didn't need any referee. And so I was out there just playing with him, and dang if he didn't throw me down. And I got a hold of him, just went over and picked him up and threw him down. Put him down. I shouldn't have just... And then I went to playing with him, and I'll be darned if he didn't get a hold on me, and he got me down. Now, that was 2 out of 3, and I... While all this was going on, Ben Housley went by the road, and he rushed over to Horace's. And Horace lived over here in town, and went to where Horace was, and Orville said, "Well, he's not here." And said, "Why?" And said, "Well, Lynn and Reed are out there just fighting." Said, "Not get Horace to go stop it." And said, "Stop it, even stop it. If he's here, he'd run over there to watch it." Said, "There may have been somebody in the shed watching it then." And he said, "Well, I don't understand that." And she said, "Well, this is a different bunch." Said, "These dang kids wrestle and play." And that's kind of the way we grew up. Reed and Howard and I used to go courting together. Howard was kind of bashful, and he'd drive in the car. And he always went along for a chauffeur, and Reed and I finally ganged up on him and said, "Now, you're either going to get a girl and go with us, because we don't need a chauffeur nor chaperone." But I know this... 36 Chevy had a standard shift right out here in the middle of that front seat. And the girl I had her dress over that gear shift.
But that gear shift was just in the way anyway. And I'm going up a hill, and I felt the car jerking along, and I looked over there, and old Howard was just going out of his mind. That girl had her dress over that gear shift. And he had to shift gears, and he didn't dare get over that gear shift. And I said, good crime, and he moved your dress so before he has a heart attack. Oh, she said, I wondered what was the matter, but anyway. But we played together and wrestled together. And Reed got married Ethel. And, oh, and we talked about it, and I didn't really. But anyway, I tried living with him, and that just didn't work. Ethel didn't know how to make bread. I'd been a family bread maker for years, and I tried to teach her how to make bread. And that's some circus. She'd put more salt in it. She put so much salt in it that she couldn't eat it. Reed was the only one that could eat it. I couldn't eat it, and she couldn't eat it. And he always cussed me that I should have eaten that bread, and I couldn't do it. Throw it out and start over. Reed made some biscuits once in our batching days, and put tooth powder in instead of bacon powder. At night he throwed them out to the dog and almost killed the dog. But living with them didn't work. Just didn't work. And I've never wanted any of my kids to live with some of the married kids. That just don't work. When I came home from my mission, I tried living with Howard and Orly for a while, and we just had to separate, because that just don't work. Now, with all due respects to them, that just don't work. Now, this matter and all these things, and the way I grew up and the experiences I had with my brothers and all, has had quite an influence on me and in the direction to which I've directed my family. Now, just raising kids and starting to school. Now, Ray started out to school. Gosh, the next year he was so thrilled to take Glenn over and introduce him as, this is my younger brother. And when Nada come along, why, I remember seeing those two skipping down the road with Nada in between them, a hold of each hand, heading for school. And they went right into their first grade teacher, and here's our sister. And that's about the way it went. And Jed come along. Well, let's quit here for a minute. Jed come along, and he would go to school, and he'd tell all these yarns. Windiest kid in the world. That he didn't like school. Now, the matter of working was just not in his nature, I guess. And the dang kid wouldn't study, and every year it was just touch and go whether you'd pass him or whether you wouldn't. And the darn kid got up and I guess he never did really study until his sophomore year in high school. He went out for football, and he said he wanted to go out for football, and so we had to buy him a pair of shoes, get him squared around, get him going. And I told him, I said, now this is going to be hard, but stay with it, and we'll take you off the chores. And he'd come along, and if you'd ever see a kid limp on both feet as he'd get off that athletic bus, They run 50 pounds off him that first fall. Then he grew about 4 inches. It just made all the difference in the world in that kid. And he'd come home and eat his supper and crawl upstairs, and he had, his bed was a low one, and he'd lay his books out there and he'd study. And that year, that quarter, he can't believe he got all A's, first time in his life. And I said, good land, look here. Now we know you can get A's. And Jed went on. Done real fine school after that. Finally got going. Judy come along, I don't know what, 2-3 years behind Jed, something. They said, oh, Jed's sister. So she said they put her down in the dummy class, and that made her so mad that she'd come home with those flashcards and let's see what's going on here. She'd take those flashcards and she'd sit on that stool and she'd make that native flash those cards to her until she just knew everything there was. And then they didn't have a room to put her up there, and so they asked her if she'd stay there anyway, and she did. And then on she was to head the class. That darn kid, and then Neil come along behind her, and he thought he ought to keep up with her. And I didn't realize for quite a while the competition between kids. When Ray and Glenn used to study, and they took an algebra class in high school together, and I didn't like that. I said, I don't like that. Well, Glenn always got better grades than Ray, and I think Ray beat him in algebra here. Glenn said they'd go upstairs to study, and Ray'd lay his head down on the book and go to sleep. Glenn would go ahead and study, and he'd wake Ray up and ask him, Ray'd tell him the answers, and then he'd go back to sleep. Getting kids to study, everybody's wound up a little different. But the competition, I believe, between Neil and Judy in studies was the keenest of the bunch. I think. Now, Nancy and Mark got a little competition. Craig come along and... good land. I think I told a story about him being fed thyroid pills before he would talk. And when he went, maybe it was between his first year and his second year that he went to Edith Bowen School all summer. He went down to college time or two, a summer or two along, and kind of get him going. And I remember this story on him. Mrs. Mills was his first grade teacher. This is Craig. And one night I'd come home from work, and I was out to Thiokol then, and sitting there by him eating supper, and I noticed he was just sitting there with his head down, and I said, what's the matter, Craig? And he began to cry. And finally, when we got him stopped and got him around, he said, I told Mrs. Mills that I couldn't do that. And she just took her thumb and she thumbed me in the back and made me do it. And I said, well, did you do it? And he said, yeah, but I told her I couldn't. And I said, well, but then she knew you could. I said, good crime. If I tell you to do something you didn't do it, I'd spat you. That'd be worse than thumbing you in the back, wouldn't it? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, come on, she's pretty good to you. But he just kind of come along here, and I used to tell him that when he studied, he had to do more to hold that book. It just wouldn't go in there by osmosis or some way. You had to read it. Now, he could take a book, and he still can sit right down in the chair and watch the television and think he's absorbing what's in that book, but it just don't go in that way. But Craig's come along, and he's filled a fine mission, and we're going to get in this missionary business time later. Now he's a struggling at college. And it's quite a struggle. Now Mark and Nancy come along and went to school a year apart. And they were real competitive. I remember one quarter, like in one semester in high school, Mark beat Nancy in grade-wise. And she looked at me and said, he'll never do that again as long as he lives. And I don't believe he has. Now, it wasn't the fact that he couldn't have done it, but she studied harder. Now, Mark got to tooting that horn in that band, and I don't know when he, how he ever learned to play it. He never did practice. Nancy come along in the band, and those kids went with the band. Neil went with the band. Judy, when she got to high school, went in the newspaper business. And that was quite an experience. But and Neil stayed with the band, and Mark stayed with the band. Nancy stayed with the band, but Nancy got to debating. And I remember Norris Mickelson tell me once, he said, you know, these kids are just gone too much. And I said, what are you talking about? Said his girl was gone a lot. Had too many meetings, had too much church to do, and had too much of this. And I said, good land. I said, you don't even know the half of it. I said, I generally talk to Nancy Wednesday, sometimes Thursday night, but never later than Thursday morning or something, but she'd leave every week. That's the last I'd see her. And she'd take what money she needed. She was a good worker. I didn't pay her salary, but we'd try to round up what she needed. And she'd go debate every weekend somewhere. Sometimes they'd leave Thursday night after school. Sometimes they'd leave Friday morning. Sometimes they'd leave Saturday morning. And then they wouldn't get home till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So I asked her if she'd come in quiet. If there's something she needed to tell me, why, that's just fine. But if anything could wait till morning, why, let's wait it till morning. And that's kind of the agreement I've had with most of the kids. And so I told Norris, I said, generally it's Wednesday night I visit with her a few minutes, and that's the last I see her till I go to get her out of bed Sunday morning so that she make it up and lead the songs in junior Sunday school. Now that last year that she was in high school, Bishop Karen often said, my land, that girl just runs between jobs. And she was Laurel class president, on the debate team, played with the band, in the pep band, and she was just on the go every minute. Now tonight, this is the 18th of May, 1979. Gary graduated from seminary. Now next Thursday night, why, he'll graduate from high school. I believe everything's in order. Now, he had a hard time in school, and when he got to going, it just wasn't working. And he went the first year to kindergarten, and he didn't learn a thing. not a thing. No, we just couldn't give up to that. We, by golly, that just, somebody said, oh, I never learned, but we just couldn't give up. We just couldn't give in to that. And the next year, he was going to take kindergarten over, and he wouldn't learn any more that year than he was before. And so we got him moved down to Smithfield to the special education. Now, let's check on here. Lenny, and he got going down there, and you know, he come along, and when it was time for his class to go to junior high, well, he wanted to go with him. And and his teachers thought he'd be all right. And so I went over to North Cache to Keith Clayson, the principal, and sat down and visited with him about it. And that was the year he started to go to Mutual. Now, he hadn't gone to primary with the kids. We just couldn't get him back for primary, and so he did most of his primary work in Smithfield. Get out of special ed, and he'd go to primary down there. And, well, there just wasn't any other way we could figure out. Some years he didn't go, but most of the primary that he got was in Smithfield. So actually, he went to Sunday school with these kids, but he didn't get to know them. So he would start going scout meeting. And they'd push him off. You know, he'd been down to that dummy school, I guess what they called it. Could he call it worse than that? I don't know. But oh, and he'd come home from primary a-crying. From Mutual a-crying. This kid had picked on him and that kid. Oh, my land, Julia, she'd sit down, ball with him, and she was going to go to Mutual, and no, you can't go to Mutual. And it come around to the point that many years ago I'd read a story about a fellow that was over in France in the army in World War II, I guess. He was stationed over there after the war, and he married a French girl. She was of the well-to-do Frenchman. And when he came back to America, he brought her with him, and she stayed with him, and they had a little boy, and this little boy was a year or two old, and she finally didn't like America, and she divorced her husband and took the little boy, went back to France. Well, she didn't raise the boy. She had a nurse do it. She didn't have time for him. And so this guy started, and time he got through the French courts and got custody of that boy, he was in his early teens. And he said, my land, he came over here, and I was so thrilled to have him. Let's see if we're taken. He was so thrilled to have that boy, but he wouldn't dress like the American boys. He dressed like a French kid. And he wouldn't go to school unless the nurse went with him. And so the kids all teased him. A man said, I just couldn't stand it. My boy that I'd loved so hard, so long, and now I had him, and he was a sissy. So he used to go to some of these kids about the kid's size. He'd say, give you a dollar if you'd roll that sissy in the mud. That was his own boy he was sicking this kid on. And he kind of rotated that around between some of the boys so they could all get their dollar. Then he'd go home, and the boy and the nurse would come, and they'd just be furious. Ruined his clothes. And he said, well, I'll buy you some more. Come on. I'm sorry. I'll buy you some more. And that way, he got him around. And in the clothes, like the rest of the kids wore. And this kind of helped a little, but not much. And so he'd every once in a while slip out to this one kid and say, hey, I give you a dollar, you roll that sissy in the mud. And finally, one day, he said, hey, do you want to earn a dollar? And he said, no way. No way, I want nothing to do with it. Oh, now, wait a minute. Before this, he had said, this boy had said to his dad, we don't need this nurse, do we? And call her my name. And he said, no, I don't think so. Said she'd like to go back to France, and I believe I'm willing to let her go. And so he made arrangements and gave her a month's salary and got her passage back to France. Then they went on, and he kept a dues in this dollar business. Finally, one day, he went to this one kid and said, I'll give you a dollar. Want to earn a dollar? And he said, no way. He said, that kid whipped the biggest kid in class today. I don't want nothing to do with him. So then the dad went hunting his boy. And he found him out to the ball field. They were playing ball, playing baseball. And his boy was pitching. And he said, I sit there and just thrilled with that. He'd now been accepted. And he said, and I got out my notebook and realized I'd spent $16 in this type of business to get the boy to where I wanted him to be. I realized a little bit of that. Mark had fought most of the battles for Gary. And I remember going to junior high, why? I can't remember which year Gary was. I guess Gary was in the 7th grade when Mark was in the 9th, and so it was the next year. I know one kid was a picking on him in that 7th grade. Another one was a cuffing him around pretty bad. Another kid come along and said, do you want to quit? Or do I go get his brother Mark? And that kid said, oh, please don't tell Mark. I'll stop. Please don't tell Mark. So the next year, Mark was down to high school, and this one darn kid, he'd come along to Gary and tell him to take his pants off. He wouldn't do it, and so then he'd kick him. Riding the unspeakable plays. And he come home just crying to his mother one night about that. And she was about ready to go to school with him. And I said, no, let's do it another way. I said to Mark, can you handle that? And he said, yeah, I can handle that. So the next day on the way to school, he stopped. And I never heard any more about it. I never heard any more about it. I got so curious, I said to Gary, how'd you work out in that? Oh, he said, Mark talked to that boy, and he hasn't bothered me since. Yeah, he talked to him. He picked him up and set him up there on that brick wall, hold him with one hand, and speaking to him, and the kid understood what Mark was talking about. But the time come, I told Mark he had to quit. Now, maybe he'd have to teach Gary to fight, but most of the kids that teased and tormented him was about like Craig. Now, they just rode poor old Craig to death. But his junior year in high school, all those hecklers had quit school and wasn't going, and that's about the way it was with Gary. Time he got to his junior year, they started leaving him alone. Now, Mark got in a lot of dang nonsense. The kids that torment Craig, why, Mark had to whip a few of them, and he did that. And I like dang kid fighting all the time. I was just happiest man in the world when he got out of high school. Pollocker gotten enough rounds down there that I told him if he keep his mouth shut, he might could be buried in a rosewood casket. But I put a lot of pressure on him that last year to get him shut his mouth and let it go. Because once you get on that black list, you're a long time ever coming off. But I know Craig enjoyed the last 2 years of high school. And that's about the way Gary was. He enjoyed those last couple of years. He's just ready to graduate now. And this last year as a senior, Gary's worked as a janitor in this international housing company there south of Smithfield. They make houses right in that big old building and then take them out and set them on a foundation. He'd work down there half a day and then he'd go to school half day. It's worked out right well. I believe he does a pretty good job as a janitor. You know, everybody needs to learn to work. And so, this is about the way it is. I was talking about this business to Mark one time, and I said, you know, as I look back over my kids, I don't know if they tormented the girls, but at least the boys, Neil had less heckling than any of them, and I was trying to figure out why. Well, Mark said he's run with the meanest dang bunch of kids, and everybody knew how mean they were. Said some of those guys, I believe it was old Steve Olson, said he'd run a race with you, he'd fight you, he'd wrestle you, or anything else. And I guess old Hard Morrill was about the same way, I don't know, but he said those dang kids that Neil run with, he said, they're not sure what Neil is, it just means they are. And maybe that's the trick, I don't know, but I'm not so sure the heckling is bad, but it isn't all bad. Some of these rough edges on kids, that's the only place you never take it off. Now, sometimes it gets too much heckling, so you have to figure out a way to tone it down. But it seems like that's part of life for some reason. I remember when Ray was in junior high. The junior high was here in Lewiston, and he was the first of the bunch. And I know it's Tim Nelson, I believe, from Richmond, kept heckling him. And he kept talking to me about it, and I kept telling Ray he was going to have to whip him. Well, one night out here across the fence, I was talking to Silmer Jessup, and Silmer was principal there, and he said, "Does Ray talk to you tonight?" And I said, "No, I haven't seen him." "What happened?" And he said, "Well, somebody run in there in my office and said there was a fight in the locker room." And I said, "Who?" And he said, "Tim Nelson and Ray Rollins." And I said, "Who's winning?" And he said, "Ray Rollins is winning." And gosh, Silmer said, "That pleased me so well, I had to do this, and then I had to do that, and I had to do this, and the time I got down there, the fight was over, and Ray had won the fight. But he said he was just blood from one end to another. Ruined his shirt, tore off his shirt. And he said, I said to Ray, you're kind of a bloody mess. Now, if you'd like to go home and clean up, it's time to get home to be cleaned up. The afternoon and a half be gone. If you want to just stay home, and you won't have to tell your dad if you don't want to. You don't have to bring, you're not kicked out. And Ollie, mission call. And here was the oldest boy heading on a mission. And he was down his, he had fall quarter to school down to Utah State. He'd worked all summer, the summer before, down to St. George. And gosh, I didn't know, down there to run service station on graveyard shift for John and his uncle, John Whitney. And saw a newspaper where a bunch from St. George had gone up on the mountain somewhere and was carrying out some people who had got killed in an airplane wreck. There we saw our boy holding the stretcher, bringing some of them out. But anyway, he'd been down there all summer, and we got him home in time that we got him into fall quarter school, and he lived here at home and drove back and forth to school and got his mission call just for Christmas to go to the Western Canadian Mission. And good land, we was thrilled with this, and we went on and on and on, and it was real nice to have him. And they'd put a quota on, and I think Ray got the first quota. And the bishop had just cleaned out everybody in the ward that fall before, Dennis Jackson, Mark Bright, and everybody wanted to go before they put quotas on. I think Ray was the first one to go on that quota business. And oh, we were thrilled. We all went down to the airport to send him off. I remember I went to my boss out to work, and you just couldn't get a day's vacation in January to save your soul. I'd have been willing to take it, and the boss said, I said, there's 2 days I need to be in Salt Lake. I need to be down there the day that he's set apart as a missionary. And I need to be down there the day to fly him out. And I was on swing shift that month. And I said, is there any way I can get some vacation to go? And he said, good night. I'd have to write a letter, and I'd have to go right and be interviewed clear up to the general manager. And he turned to the man that went to Orrin Baird that was scheduling the work and said, Lindsay's got to take his boy to Dr. Harold B. Lee 2 different days, and he'll tell you which days. And Baird said, fine, and that's all there was to it. So anyway, We were thrilled to go down and watch him set apart. And I believe it was Brother Howard W. Hunter set him apart. Then we went down on a Sunday night and heard them bear their testimony in the assembly hall. And I remember a little boy with dark rimmed glasses got up. He was from McGrath, Canada. And he said, "I've done a lot of talking in my day in church, but it's always been in that back corner." I guess they have back corners in church houses all over. So then Sunday night we brought Ray home with us. He didn't go out till Monday night. So I had Monday off and I was around house with him. And he just paced the floor that day just like a lion in a cage. And he said, "Here the day has come to go on a mission and I'm scared now." It had finally hit him. And I said, "Oh, that's the best news I've heard. I never got scared till I knocked on that door, and then I wondered what I was doing there. Never crossed my mind until then." And so Ray went up to Coaldale, Canada. At night, he's right there in southern Alberta with all our relatives. My mother had two brothers and two sisters go to Canada, to southern Alberta, and raise their families and stayed there. He had more relatives around there where he'd spent most of his mission than he did when he was in Cache Valley, right around here. But anyway, along about a year later, him and Lee Ray Reese were driving a van. They were working on the Indian Reservation. And they got in a real bad car wreck and broke Lee Ray's leg between the knee and the hip. And they were in the hospital. He was in the hospital for a week and I just fidgeted. Finally, he called us. I didn't know where he was. I didn't know. Hadn't heard from him. Told me what had gone on. And I talked to him a time or two on the telephone, but I couldn't straighten him out. Sometimes you let a lot of things that you can't do anything about bother you. And he was letting a lot of things bother him. Now, I just coaxed the Reese family to go up there and put that boy in a cast and bring him home. That's what I'd have done if it'd been my boy. Because I thought we had better doctors down here. But anyway, and I went back and forth with that Ray for about a week, and then I thought about it, and I didn't sleep one night. Then I got tuned up, and I remembered Reed writing me a letter when I was real sick and discouraged in the mission field. And I settled down, and I wrote Ray a 6-page letter, and he made him so mad he burnt it, and I thought that's what he ought to do anyway. But a dad plays an important part in a kid being on a mission. And I've promised every kid, including him, that if they ever got homesick or discouraged, let me know and I would get them out of it. Ray said it made him so mad he burnt the letter. And after he calmed down, he wished he'd have kept it. I'm glad he burned it. Glenn was getting ready to go on a mission at that time, and he talked to the bishop, and he was going to go that June. He couldn't get a quota till April. Bishop had promised him the quota, and he told him he'd take it, go in June. So I said, "Now, Glenn, you better read this before you go, if you get homesick and discouraged, I'll send you one just if I like it. But Ray filled a good mission. We had Ray and Glenn out together for 6 months. Gosh, we got all ready to go get Ray. I want to go get every kid. Me mission. I'd taken the time off. I'd got vacation out to work, and I'd taken it off to go between Christmas, New Year's, and get him. And my land that night before we left, we were watching the television, and it said there's a storm clear from here up into Canada, from the coast clear across through Utah, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Montana, and everything till you just couldn't see. So I called Ray. They expected it to snow for 3 days, and we just couldn't make it. All these kids stand here bawling. You told us we could go, but we just couldn't go. It wasn't safe. That station wagon was pretty good, but to drive in a blizzard for 700 miles straight north and then turn right around and drive back, I just couldn't do it. So I called Ray, and he said, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "I'd catch a bus over to Lethbridge and get on the Greyhound and come home." And Julia was standing there and said, "Put him on the airplane." I said, "I can't in a blizzard. The airplanes aren't flying." And so we followed the course of and checked with the bus system, and got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and went up to Preston to meet him. And I said, "Buy your ticket to Preston and we'll meet you there." So we all got out of bed and went up to Preston, and there we met him. That was a long ways from going up to Carson to get him. Now, Glenn had been in England about 6 months when Ray came home. And Ray started school. And oh, here's where we got going. I knew I couldn't go to England. I told Glenn when he left that the old Dodge couldn't swim, so I didn't think I'd come get him. Of course, he got home his mission one night, and the next day went with us to the temple for Ray to be married, Ray and Rosemary to be married. Then we went along, and old Jed come along to go on a mission. And I remember President Anderson said to him, "Now, Jed, whose idea is this going on a mission, yours or your dad's?" He said, "President Anderson, I stood down at that airport and just bawled, waiting for my turn to go on a mission. It's now here, and I'm ready to go. I'm raised to go on a mission. And I've just lived for that day, and it's now here." And President Harrison looked at him, and as he told me about it, he said, "You know, I guess that's right. I guess that's just what it is." I remember when Ray was stationed in Fort McLeod, Canada, right north of Lethbridge. One night we was watching television, and it said there was a blizzard that had blocked the roads in Fort McLeod, took down telephone lines, power lines, blocked all the roads. There's no mail going in, no, nothing. They were there. They were stranded. Julia said, "Get on that phone, call Ray, see if he's all right." And I said, "Hey, they just said the telephone lines were down." Well, about a week, we heard from him. He said that they saw this blizzard coming. And so they headed for their apartment, and they got the car off the road and got into the apartment, and they had a little food there. Now, I don't know, they were there for a couple of days, and that car was snowed right over after the blizzard quit. Then they got some cats and dozed it out, got them alive, and then they got out. And we got two letters from him all the same day, one before the blizzard and one after. But that was kind of an anxious week. Well, let's see here.